Welcome to the Estate Planning Project. My name is Mary Bart, Chair of Caregiving Matters. Our purpose with this project is public education on a wide range of estate planning topics. With a growing aging population, unprecedented wealth transfer from one generation to the next, and the dramatic rise in estate litigation, the need for estate planning public education has never been greater. This is a technology-based project that will produce podcasts, articles, and blog posts. As a social collaborative initiative, experts such as lawyers, estate planners, and financial planners will share their thoughts and ideas on a bottomless pit of estate planning topics. This project offers general information only and is not a substitute for seeking personalized professional advice. And our guest expert today is Christine Anderson, and she is a partner with Bales Beal, and they are a law firm based in Toronto, Ontario. To give you a little bit of a background about Christine, her practice focuses on estate and civil litigation, and for the purposes of this podcast, Christine helps clients find the best path for delivering effective and creative advice on estate matters, power of attorney disputes, and guardianship applications. Welcome, Christine, to our project.
Thank you very much.
Well, we're thrilled to have you here, and the topic for our podcast is called Hidden Issues Arising Out of Second and Third Marriages and Also Divorce. So, Christine, to begin, I have a series of questions for you, and the first one is this. What obligations exist upon your death to provide for spouses and children? And if you could also help answer two other questions, what is the definition of a spouse, and what is the definition of a child?
So during your lifetime, you may have entered into a relationship from which legal responsibilities flow. And when you pass away, the law does not relieve you of any responsibilities that may have been established through these relationships just because you've passed away. So what we're speaking about today is what obligations the law will recognize after you pass away. And one of those is that you must properly provide for certain people in your life. This is in the situation of whether or not we are looking at somebody who has a will or somebody who passes away without a will. When you pass away without a will, there are certain laws that dictate who gets what, essentially, who's first in line and how your estate will trickle down through your spouses or your children. So if in any of these situations, either through a will or if you pass away without a will, there are people who either deliberately have been left out or maybe inadvertently have been left out, that the court, they may have the opportunity to apply to the court to have their situation assessed and whether or not the deceased, because this is all happening after you've passed away, whether or not the deceased should have properly provided for you. Now, I am in Ontario, so I'm going to start there with the Ontario law. It is different from province to province. This is an area that is legislated by provincial legislation, so provinces have their own ability to draft that legislation. There are provinces that have similar situations, similar laws, but I'm going to start with Ontario. So in Ontario, the court will look at whether or not you've made adequate provision for the proper support of your dependents, and the court then has the opportunity, if you haven't, to make an award out of your estate that will properly support your dependents. That is governed by, in Ontario, by a section of our legislation called the Succession Law Reform Act. And in order to qualify to apply to the court saying that I've been left out and I don't feel I've been properly provided for, you have to meet a definition of a spouse or a child. There are some other people who may qualify, but we're focusing on spouses and children today. And in Ontario, the legislation specifically says that you must be someone to whom the deceased was providing support at the time of their death. So you have to be a spouse or a child who the deceased was providing support to or was under a legal obligation to provide support to. So that raises a couple of questions right off the bat, one of which was raised in the first opening question, which is who is defined as a spouse and who is defined as a child? But I'm actually going to answer another question first to start, which is, what does it mean when the legislation says you must be providing support? And what that means is that it can be, I'm going to give some examples, maybe that's the best way to do it. If there's an outstanding order for child support that has not been fulfilled, that's a situation where the court would probably say, you know, you had an obligation to provide support to that child and you didn't do so. So if later when you pass away, if you haven't provided for that child in your will, or if you pass away on an intestacy, meaning you passed away without a will, and that child doesn't enter into the list of people who may collect somehow, then your estate likely would be ordered to provide that child support. Also, in the situation where spouses may be separated, and sometimes separation can take a while, so there hasn't been a formal support order made by the court, and perhaps one of the spouses has entered into a second relationship, but no one has figured out yet what the proper support is for their first spouse. That first spouse may be somebody, if they have been left out of a will, that they could apply to the court to seek redress. So essentially, it's a situation where the practical way to think about it is, if you're living with someone, or you have lived with someone, or you've had a child with them, likely that person is going to be able to say to the court, look, I was dependent upon this person and I was left out. There's also situations where children or spouses who are receiving regular payments in some way, sometimes people separate and they set up an informal arrangement with children or with spouses where they're paying for school or they're paying for someone's rent or something like that, that can also establish this situation of reaching that threshold of someone is providing you support. So I will now move on to talk about who is a child and who is a spouse. And you would think that this would be pretty easy to figure out, but actually it gets a little complicated. So a child can be a child of someone who's passed away if they are conceived before that person passes away, but are born after they pass away. That meets the definition of child. It is also children to whom the deceased has demonstrated a settled intention to treat as a child. So that can be, you know, kind of the more informal arrangements that sometimes exist in families where someone takes in a relative's child for whatever reason. That person can fit the definition of a child. And there was also recently a very interesting amendment to the Ontario legislation that covers some of the realities of our present day life, where the reality is that people are freezing their eggs and freezing their sperm in order to potentially conceive children in the future. And the Ontario legislation has now opened up the door for children who are actually conceived after death through in vitro fertilization or a surrogate, a frozen egg planted in a surrogate or something of that nature, that they may meet the definition of child as well. There's certain criteria to be set out there, but it's very interesting that as our world changes, the law evolves to meet those challenges. The definition of who is a spouse has also recently changed in Ontario. The old definition of spouse was anybody who had been married to each other, and it didn't matter if that marriage had been terminated or not, so it didn't matter whether or not you got divorced, and it also included people who have lived together for a period of at least 3 years or were in a relationship of some permanence with the child. The second part of that definition of spouse has not changed, so common law spouses can still qualify, but what's interesting is that the first part of that definition has changed. So initially, under that definition, the door was opened for divorced spouses to apply to the court to say they were not properly provided for. Now in Ontario, it appears with this new change to the legislation that divorced spouses may not be able to apply to the court to be provided for support, which is, it'd be interesting to see how that plays out. The law just changed recently, so there hasn't been a lot of decided case law in the area. And I should also point out that some of the changes I've talked about that have happened in Ontario may not have occurred across Canada because, as I've said, the legislation is dealt with by the provincial government. Each province may be at different speeds with some of these issues. I don't think all of the provinces yet have the language to include children born after the deceased passed away within the legislation, so those in vitro kind of fertilization scenarios. I also know that British Columbia and Nova Scotia do not have a requirement that the person who indicates that they have been not properly provided for under the will be financially dependent on the deceased. So that actually opens the doors in some of those provinces to adult independent children being able to apply to the court if they are left out of somebody's will, which is not the case in Ontario. In Ontario, that person would have a very difficult time bringing an application under this legislation. They may have other avenues to pursue, but under this legislation, they would not qualify if they're not financially dependent.
Well, thank you for that very detailed explanation, which leads me to my next question. What happens if you do not properly provide for a spouse or child when you die?
Well, first off, your spouse or child is probably going to be a little surprised, and it can create quite a rift in a family relationship. So it is something to think about when you are doing your estate planning. Who's going to be left to deal with these issues when you pass away? But as stated, there are some mechanisms that your spouse, whoever meets the definition of spouse, and your child, whoever meets the definition of child, can use to apply to the court. And one of those is an application for support, saying that the estate has not properly provided for them. And when you make that application to the court, you will have that person applying will have to make a very fulsome, usually an affidavit, outlining all of the evidence the court needs to determine all of the issues that they will assess. So this will pertain to your relationship to the deceased's financial means, and any obligations that the deceased had. And it can get very personal. And I think this is something for people to consider as well. When you are making your plans for what happens to your estate when you pass away, if you do leave somebody out, they may feel they have no other recourse to make this kind of application, and it is going to be exposing everyone's lives in a public process, in the court process. So that is a factor to think about. In Ontario, you only have 6 months to file your application if you're someone who's been left out of the will or you didn't receive anything on an intestacy. And that 6 months runs from the time that the estate trustee is officially appointed by the court. So that I don't know the limitations period in every single province to apply for relief if you have been left out of a will, but I absolutely would suggest that every province would have a time frame, and it's likely quite short. And the reason why it's quite short is that the lawmakers want estates to be able to be distributed, to be closed off without having to wait to see if there's any kind of applications out there that may disrupt the distributions from the estate. Also something to think about if you are someone who feels they've been left out is that you have to, if you're bringing this application, you have to serve it on everybody who has an interest in the estate. And that can be quite a number of people. And it could potentially, certainly could be former spouses included in that, children from first marriages included in that. And that can raise a lot of issues in families and can become a bit hairy.
And Christine, just to add to your point there, you are clearly speaking about Ontario, but in this project, we're really asking people wherever they live in the country to go and find a lawyer. And if they had that question about how long are we allowed to wait, is it 6 months, is it 4 months, whatever, every lawyer in the country would be able to help them. So if they lived in Vancouver or Halifax, when people listening to this podcast have specific questions, we always say, go find a lawyer where you live and ask those questions. They will be able to help you through that. So thank you for specifically mentioning that the laws will vary from province to province. And what we're really saying is people go out and find lawyers to help you through these questions that you have.
Absolutely. Educate yourself so that you know what your rights are, and then you can decide how you wish to proceed.
Absolutely. Thank you for that, too. My next question is, what factors are considered in assessing whether a spouse or a child is properly provided for?
The list of factors is incredibly long. And as I mentioned when I was talking about what kind of evidence you'd have to put before the court, and I mentioned that it's going to touch on every aspect of the person's life and your life as well. So the factors are going to be, what kind of relationship did you have with the deceased? How long did that last? You will have to set out a pretty much a family tree of the deceased and so that the court can understand, are there any other people who may have not been properly provided for as well? The deceased age, your physical and mental health, because that will define what your needs are. The court will also look at what is your standard of living that you've been accustomed to if you're, you know, in a relationship with the deceased. What is your ability to generate your own, to become self-sufficient yourself? The court will look at what kind of work the deceased was in. Did you help out in the business? The court will have to look at what the liabilities of the estate are as well, because if the court is looking at whether or not they're going to make an award to provide for you, they have to make sure that the estate can pay all of their liabilities as well first. Liabilities always get paid first. And then we're looking at what's left over to distribute to everybody else. As I said, there will be quite an intense scrutiny into your situation as well as the deceased situation. All of that goes into the court by way of an affidavit. And then the court does what it so often does in many situations. It looks at all of these factors and it does some balancing. It's balancing the rights, basically, of all who may be competing for an interest in this estate. I mean, there may be a situation where there is a will and there are other named beneficiaries, so the court will be mindful that those beneficiaries, their gifts maybe don't get completely revoked. Maybe they get partially revoked. Maybe those gifts stand and you get a portion of what's left over. The court's discretion in these situations is quite broad, and when we look at the decisions the court make, you can see that they're very, very, very factually driven. So there's not a formula to figure this out. They'll look at all of the circumstances. For example, there are claims for support in this instance that don't succeed because maybe the deceased provided for the person in question a little, but not enough, but the estate just isn't big enough to make an award. And vice versa, sometimes if the estate is very large, the court will have more leeway to ensure that the person who is making their claim, if they meet the criteria that they qualify, that the court may award them more funds to be able to maintain a certain lifestyle that they've become accustomed to if the estate has the money to do that. So there's all kinds of balancing that the court has to do.
Thank you for that answer. My next question is, what tools do the courts have to remedy any situation?
The tools they have are very broad. And as I said, they have a lot of discretion in how they apply them. First off, the court can award if they see that a monetary sum is a way to deal with the situation. They can either award a lump sum payment from the estate, or they can award periodic payments. So sometimes, you know, a yearly payment or a monthly payment of some sort. Now, generally, the court favors the lump sum approach, and that has kind of practical aspect driving that. And it's because, again, if there was periodic payments, the estate would have to stay open for many, many, many years when it may not be necessary to do that. If all of the other beneficiaries have received their gifts, all of the liabilities have been satisfied, why keep the estate open for the next 20 years just to make these periodic payments? The court probably in that situation would make a lump sum payment. But the other remedy that I think is very interesting and that people may not be aware of is that, you know, we talk a lot as estate planners about creating situations where assets may pass outside of the will. We refer to it that way. And that means property held jointly that may pass to another person by right of survivorship, or maybe an RRSP that has a designated beneficiary, or an insurance policy that has a dedicated beneficiary. So something that people need to be aware of, in most provinces, and I don't think this power exists in British Columbia, but in most provinces, the court will look into not only what's available in the estate itself, so what's left in the estate, but we'll look at any of gifts made before the person passed away, look at any of these joint ownership situations, look at who received money under insurance policies and under any other designations, and the court has the power to essentially claw those gifts back into the estate, claw those designations or that property that passed jointly back into the estate to determine the value of the estate to then make a decision about how much would be paid to the person who was left out. And that's I think that would come as quite a surprise to a lot of people that the court would have that power. You think that you're making these decisions about who are your beneficiaries, thinking that's locked in and nothing will touch that. But there absolutely are situations where the court can attack those designations and those gifts that have passed outside the will. Now, in British Columbia, I mentioned the legislation doesn't allow this express clawback, but there are other ways that if this happens and you're in British Columbia, that you may be able to attack a gift or a transfer of property prior to someone's death. You may do it as a fraudulent conveyance that someone was trying to remove that from their estate in order that you wouldn't get it kind of situation. So there's options. But I did want to make everyone aware who's listening, think about the way you are planning your estate and talk to your lawyers about ways that you can avoid these situations, in particular if you are planning, for whatever reason, to perhaps not leave something to someone who feels that they likely would qualify for something under the will.
And thank you for that information, because you know what? I bet people didn't understand that until you explained it right now. And I bet there are some eyebrows being raised as people listen to this podcast. And it really says, when we look at this whole topic of estate planning, this is really so complicated and so complex. And what you've done is very high level discussions on this. And it really means, people, you really need to go and speak with lawyers and talk about what you want, and the lawyers will help you create a plan that gives you peace of mind and gives fairness and peace of mind to the people that you love. And so with that, I would say thank you so much, Christine, for joining our project. Could you please share your contact information?
Well, thank you very much for having me. The Bales Beal website is www.balesbeal.com, BalesBeal.com. And I'll give everyone my direct line in case anyone has any questions, is 416-203-4548.
Thank you, Christine. And people can follow our project at www.caregivingmatters.ca. Thank you.